Now, you may remember that last Wednesday evening we were looking in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 1 at verse number 21, and that verse, "Behold, the Lord thy God hath set the land before thee, go up and possess it, as the Lord God of thy fathers hath said unto thee, fear not, neither be discouraged." And I mentioned to you last time that I was prompted to speak on that verse because it happened to be the reading of Charles Haddon Spurgeon in his marvelous little collection of daily readings, the Checkbook of the Bank of Faith. And the 6th of August reading was, in fact, Deuteronomy chapter 1 at verse 21. I mentioned to you that I'm not a habitual addict of these daily readings. They're a good thing, and I know a lot of people who derive a great deal of discipline and encouragement from them, and that, of course, is what they're intended to be and to do, and we have no quarrel. God bless the readings of these little booklets. I do something slightly different, but I do dip in. I've got quite a number of these little collections of daily readings, which I find most valuable because I dip into them perhaps in times of need or such like things. But I did mention to you last time that the reading was for that occasion last week in that verse 21 in chapter 1. Now, it so happens to be that I did intend to go on following on from what we were saying last time, but those of you who do have the readings in Mr. Spurgeon's checkbook of the Bank of Faith will know that the reading for the following day, the 7th of August, is in fact the text that we're going to be looking at in fact this evening. It follows naturally. And it I'm prompted again to take up this text because we are looking in our Sunday morning services over the past few weeks at the events surrounding the entrance into the Promised Land, and in our Sunday evening services, the questions that we've been looking at. You remember, what do you mean by this service? And last Sunday evening, what do these stones mean? Out of Joshua chapter 4. And the verse that we're looking at this evening is again in the book of Joshua. We're trying to, as it were, keep striking while the iron is hot, or at least warm, and the topic is before us. And one can hardly think of a more suitable statement to consider together this evening than the one that we have in Joshua chapter 1 at verse number 7. And this happens to be the text that Mr. Spurgeon has for the following day. And I think that it's probably more than merely providential for us. But anyway, whatever be the ultimate source of why men write down these particular texts, we're looking at this verse this evening because it fits into what we are looking at generally the past number of weeks, and it fits in with following on from what we were thinking about last Wednesday evening. The command was to go in and to possess the land. We were speaking about the land, basically, and the possession of the land, and so on. And here we have the opening chapter in the book of Joshua, which is the history book of the conquest, or the partial conquest of the land, of the Promised Land. And at the very beginning, Joshua is being encouraged after the death of Moses. Moses had been with the people so long, he was almost, as it were, a one-man institution. He had been their leader, he'd been their judge, he'd been their prophet, he had been the miracle worker among them. They had perhaps come to depend upon him, and now on the very verge of crossing the Jordan, Moses has died on the east bank of the Jordan. And now they are bereft of their great leader. But the Lord is assuring Joshua and assuring the people that as he had been with Moses, so he was going to be with Joshua. And in the last verses of the chapter, we are reminded of how just as the people of Israel on that occasion had to listen to the voice of Moses, because he was the official, authentic, infallible teacher in Israel for them, so Joshua is going to be the new man, and they're to follow what he commands, and they're to listen to what he says, and indeed upon pain of death, if they will not listen and do, then we're told in the last verse, they will be put to death. So serious would be the crime of rebelling against God's appointed leader, Joshua. So that's the general picture, and there are certain directives given to Joshua to pass on to the people to make preparation for 3 days later. They're going to start marching towards the River Jordan, and we were looking at that last Sunday evening, the crossing of the Jordan and the setting up of the cairn, the pillar of stones, as a commemoration. Well, here we have a statement dealing with part of the instruction that the Lord spoke to Joshua to prepare him for the task of preparing the people. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. Now, this is only part of a wider statement, as we see. And we have to keep in mind the context. But nonetheless, we do want to focus in specifically on what is being spoken about in this particular verse. And what is being spoken about is that the people are being commanded to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded thee, not to turn from it to the right hand or to the left, because therein, in doing according to all the law, the Lord assures Joshua and the people that therein lies their prosperity and their success and indeed their truest and highest happiness. And this is what we want to think about, particularly this evening. So the first thing that we want to emphasize is, what specifically is it that the Lord is commanding Joshua in this particular statement? Be thou strong, very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded thee. So what is being commanded is that the people of Israel are to do according to all the law. And they're to be strong in doing this and courageous. They're to give themselves to it wholeheartedly. We shall see this later on in the sermon, God willing. But the point that I want to emphasize is it is the law particularly that is in view. And it is the law in verse number 8, this book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night. Now, it's obvious that the book of the law that is being referred to is the writings of Moses. And the Jews, as you know, I'm sure you know, the Jews regarded the law, the Torah, not simply in terms of the Ten Commandments, but in terms of the teaching. In fact, the Hebrew word Torah, law, is not just law. It means teaching. It means a way of life presented in writing. And the first five books of the Old Testament, they are much more than just law in the sense of precepts and prohibitions. They are a whole way of life presented for the people of God, explaining what life is, how God created it, how God has made them and chosen them to be a special kind of people before him. So when Joshua and the people are being commanded to do all according to the law, it is specifically the words that are already written down. The law is already written. The first five books of Moses are already in existence when this book of Joshua is being spoken and later on written down. The scripture has already begun to be recorded in writing. And just as we have the first five books of Moses in our Bibles, so the people of Israel going into the promised land, they had these books of Moses actually in their possession in the charge of the priests. There were already writings by which Joshua and the priests could go to and instruct the people from it and tell them what God actually had said. So when we think of the law, we're thinking not only of the Ten Commandments, but we're thinking of everything that Moses taught and everything that was recorded of the history of Israel up until this particular point in time. There's a new chapter beginning in the history of Israel. They are now going to possess the land. Up until this point, they had not possessed it as a nation. And as we saw on Sunday night, the promise of God for his people is now being implemented at this particular junction in history. But there is something in their possession already that records for them their beginnings, records for them the name of the God who has chosen them, brought them out of Egypt, and is now fulfilling these promises to them. And it's all written down, as it were, in a hard copy, so that the priests and Joshua and any other leader or judge or prophet who will come afterwards will be able to go to the book and actually read in the writings what did God say at that particular time. Now, you might think that that's pretty obvious. Why am I laboring the point? I'm laboring the point because when the people of Israel as a nation entered into the promised land, they already had a kind of code book. And that code book was going to shape their life, and it was going to shape their thinking, and it was going to shape what kind of people, in fact, they were going to be. But let us think, for example, specifically of the law, in terms of the summary of the law that we have in the Ten Commandments that we were reading together. And the Ten Commandments don't contain the whole of the law, but they do summarize the real meaning of the law. And the Ten Commandments were written in stone. And the Ten Commandments were engraved on two tablets of stone, and they were put into the ark, that strange golden-covered box that was carried about with the people of Israel. And so when the people of Israel entered the promised land and crossed the Red Sea, across the Jordan, you may remember, as we're saying on Sunday evening, the Ark of the Covenant went before them. And the Ark of the Covenant was there representing God's ultimate purpose and God's real presence for the people. Now, it's that code in the Ten Commandments specifically that summarizes what the law of God really means. What was Moses driving at in all those diverse commandments that he gave concerning food and drink and how far you could travel on the Lord's day, what you could do, what you couldn't do, and so on, what you could wear, and so on, what sacrifices were to be offered? What is it all about? And I think that the scholars who down through the ages have summarized the Ten Commandments in two main principles, have been absolutely right, because Christ himself sanctions it this way. The law of God, not only the Ten Commandments, but all the law, but summarized and focalized, as it were, in the Ten Commandments, emphasizes, first of all, our relationship to God. God is first. But it is a relationship to God that always has to be understood in the context of grace. We must never see the law of God divorced from grace, because the preface to the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20 is, as you know, I am the Lord your God, who have led you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Therefore, you will have no other gods before me. Therefore, you will not make any images. Therefore, you will not take my name in vain. Therefore, you will honor the Sabbath day. Therefore, you will not kill. Therefore, always there as a consequence, because of what I have done for you, this is how I want you to live as a response to me. So the Ten Commandments summarize a kind of response on our part. And it's a God-directed response. This is the way that the Lord wants us to respond to what he has done for us. He is under no obligation whatsoever to us, but we are under an obligation to him. And the real imperative for keeping and doing all according to the commandments of the law of God is simply this element of grace. It's not that we keep the law for the Lord's, for the sake of the law. We keep the law because God, who commands us to live in a certain way, has done for us a most gracious, a gospel thing. And when the people of Israel were commanded to do all according to the law, they are to see their life in relationship to God in terms of pure love and pure grace. They are to see that God is for them in a kind and a gentle and a long-suffering manner. He has put up with them for 40 years in the wilderness. He has put up with this people, the descendants of Abram, for over 400 years when they had even forgotten his name. They now know his name. They know that he is the Lord Jehovah, and they are not to forget it, and they are not to bandy it about as though it was a name that meant very little. And so the keeping of the law is always to be understood in the context of, I am the Lord who has done this for you. Now you do this for me. And that's the principle of salvation right throughout the entire scriptures. But God always comes first. And that is why the summary of the Ten Commandments, the great commandment of the law, is first of all, love to God. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. But there's another law, or there's a second commandment, and it's not the first commandment. The first commandment has to do with God. The second commandment has to do with men. And I'm emphasizing that not only because the Bible emphasizes it, because we tend to put it the other way around. And you get many people and they will say that they hope to go to heaven because they have never done their neighbor any harm and they love their neighbor as themselves. That's a very good thing to do. And it's a requirement of the law, but it's a second command. It's not the most important one. The most important one is to love God first. And it's quite possible for the natural man to love his neighbor, to be a philanthropist to the utmost degree, to give away everything that he has to feed the poor, and yet not to give one brass farthing to the cause of God in the world. And so the emphasis is on God first. The first commandment's dealing with our relationship to God, and then the second table of the law, so to speak, dealing with our relationship to other people. And it is in terms of love. You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. Now, all that is axiomatic. You say that's all obvious. We learned that in kindergarten. We learned that in Sabbath school year one. Yes, very true, and I'm sure many of us did. But have we understood the significance of the law of God? The importance of having the law in this particular way? Because what we have in these written writings of Moses that is summarized here as the law is nothing less than the maker's instructions. You and I buy a washing machine, we buy a car, we buy some complex piece of machinery, and you find in the package with which it comes, you find maker's instructions. The manual, how to handle this piece of machinery. And the manual will make it very clear, if you do what the manual tells you to do, if you change the oil every time the manual says the oil in this vehicle is to be changed every so many months or whatever, so many kilometers, the tires are to be kept at such and such a pressure, and then you will get the best possible performance out of this particular vehicle, and it is guaranteed. The guarantee is you obey the maker's instructions and all will be well. But the maker disavows any guarantee unless you follow his instructions. And if we just choose to ignore the maker's instructions, we're going to bring disaster sooner or later, because the thing has been made and designed simply to follow the maker's instructions. Now, you and I have been made in such a way that in keeping the commandments of God, there is a great reward, not only in terms of eternal joy, but in terms of temporal blessings as well. Keeping the commandments of God is the best way to live, and that basically is what the law is all about. But also it is this, it's not only the maker's instruction. God knows better than we do how we are meant to perform at maximum and to be at our happiest in life. He has given us rules, a rule book. You can't live without rules. And every nation and every individual, if we don't follow God's rules, we're going to follow our own rules or somebody else's rules. But we will follow rules. One way or the other, we are all bound by regulations of one kind or the other. Now here, the people of Israel are being commanded to be bound by God's rules, God's regulations. So first of all, these are maker's instructions, but they're also father's directions, because it's not simply that God cares for us as the one who made us. He cares for us because Israel is his firstborn son. Israel is my son, says the prophet Hosea. Let my son go. You remember how Moses went into Pharaoh. And let my son go. Israel is my son. Let him go. And so when we have these instructions that are given in the writings of Moses, we are actually given directions from a father to his son. In the same way as the book of Proverbs, you remember, my son, heed my instructions, and you will be wise. In other words, the father cares for his son. He is jealous for his son. He's not so interested in what other families do. We leave that to other families, unless there's real trouble and they need to be reported to the police or something like that. But for our own children, as Joshua is going to say at the end of this book, as for me and my family, we're going to follow the Lord. That's what Joshua said, chapter 24. And so here, right from the beginning, the people of God are being reminded that God is their father. And he cares for them, not just because he made them, but because he has redeemed them. And so to do according to the law that is written in the law of Moses is to listen to the wisest possible wisdom, to the one who knows all about us in our created nature, but also in our renewed nature. He knows our weaknesses. He understands how we are prone to backsliding and going astray. He knows all about that. And always there is this word of appeal, like the father to the recalcitrant son in the parable of the man with the two sons, you remember, Luke chapter 15, where he appeals to his other son to come in and join the happy family party because there's a happy family occasion. All that I have belongs to you, he said to the son. It's all yours. And that is precisely the point. This land, it all belongs to you. I have given it everywhere you will step upon. I have already given it unto you. So that is what the Lord is saying to the people of Israel through Joshua. He is saying what they're to do is to be of good courage and to do all according to the law that is written, Moses, my servant, commanded thee, and so on. So that's the first thing, but I must press on, because there's a second thing. And the second thing is this, well, how is it that we're to do this, or Israel is to do this, and how are we in principle to do it? Well, we need to be strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do all according to all the law, which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left. In other words, there's to be diligence. There's to be the knowledge of what the law is. You see, it's no excuse in a court of law not to know the law. You and I may not know the law. We may do some criminal or civil offense for which the policeman will haul us up and issue a summons, and we may be entirely ignorant, but that is not an excuse. Because we are meant to understand, at least in principles, the laws by which our society is to be governed. And so here the people of Israel are being encouraged that they are to think about it. They are to study it. The book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night. There are Christian people in our world today, and after many years, and I speak to them from time to time, they still haven't read the whole Bible. Now, you can read the Bible, you can read the New Testament twice in a year, and the Old Testament through once in a year, without doing too much strenuous study. The Bible is designed in such a way that you can read whole books at one sitting, if only we will be diligent about it. There are people and they say, oh, I'll read my chapter or I'll read my verse. Well, fair enough. If that's all they're able or willing to do, fine. We can't force them. But that's not the principle upon which the people of God in the Old Testament were commanded. To hear the word of the Lord means to read it or to listen to it being expounded. And I find it more than passing strange. I find it extremely disturbing, to put it mildly. There are many Christian people, even in this congregation, and they are so slack, and so lazy and so indiligent at hearing the word of God that one really wonders, what are these people on about? How serious do they take this book? Is God trifling with us? Is this something that we can pick up and leave? There are members in this congregation, and I have never seen them at a midweek meeting for years on end. There are members in this congregation, they evidently don't care to attend the Bible class, as though we're talking a lot of rubbish down there, and some object to it. We understand all that. But the people of Israel, they had before them a teaching and teachers, and they had to pay attention, because the whole welfare of their society depended upon how they squared up and faced the issues of the word of the Lord. That's the principle. How to do it is what is being commanded. It's not just that they're to do it, they're actually being told how to do it. That they're to be strong and very courageous and very diligent. And notice how they're to do it. Further, to do all according to the law, not picking and choosing, not liking some doctrines and disliking other doctrines. And also, they are not to turn to it from the right hand or to the left. What does that mean? Well, there are many different ways the scholars interpret this. But I think that what basically it means is becoming extreme one way or the other. We find it very difficult as Christian people, indeed even as people, to live a balanced life. We tend to go to extremes. And I think that the two dangers in going to the left or to the right is to become more legalistic than the law ever intended us to be. The law says to make the Sabbath a delight. And the tendency in a legalistic attitude is to make it as much of a drudgery as you can possibly make it. And they invented 365 days. Eventually, the Pharisees, they made up 365 rules by which you were to keep the Sabbath day. That was only for one commandment. Now, there's no mention of anything remotely like that in the law of Moses. In other words, they were becoming more legal than the law. They were going too much into the fine print that wasn't printed. And they were making up rules for themselves how they would observe this rule book. And all the Lord wants more than anything is not just how far you can go and whether you can drag a chair across an earth floor or spit and make clay and spit and rub your foot on it and make clay on the Sabbath day or kicking a football in the street. That's not the issue. Not even remotely the issue. The issue is love to God. And if we have that right, everything else will fall into place. And so they're not to go to the left, as it were. On the other hand, they're not to go to the right, to become too libertine and say, well, we know what the commandment says, but it can't mean that. That's too difficult. Not even to look lustfully after a woman or not to take the Lord's name in vain. That's too difficult, always being on our guard concerning all these rules and regulations. And so they would tend to drop them one by one and take shortcuts and compromise and become libertine. So there's always the danger of being too tight, and there's always the danger of being too loose in our understanding of the law. And this is what Jesus was up against in his own earthly ministry. And the prophets were up against it too. Isaiah the prophet was condemning the people for the sheer number of the sacrifices that were offering, that they were offering. And the Lord said, I never asked for this. And they were observing the Sabbath in a certain way. And the Lord said, this isn't the Sabbath that I was asking. The Sabbath that I want is for you to feed the hungry and to let the prisoners go free and take care of the poor people in your community. Make the Sabbath a delight. Go and visit sick people instead of locking yourself away behind closed doors and mourning over the spiritual diseases of the church. That's the kind of principle. Don't go to the left and don't go to the right in these matters. Have the balanced view. We could say more about that, but time will not allow us to go too much into it. So first of all, what is it that they're to do? They're to be diligent concerning all the law of God, which Moses, my servant, commanded thee. And they're to do so with a straight medium course, not going too far this way, not going too far the other day. We're keeping a balance between faith and hope and love, faith and works, and all the other aspects of righteousness that make for a happy, balanced personality and a wholesome way of living. That's what God intends for them. But then the third and final thing that we must consider this evening is, why is it? Not only what is it that they're to do and how is it that they're to go about it, but why specifically is it that they are to do what the Lord is commanding them when they enter into the land? Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. Now, the principle here is surely this. What kind of nation are they going to be? They are going to be ruled by rules of some kind. Who is going to be the ultimate lawgiver in Israel? Who is the ultimate lawgiver in Australia? Who is going to be the ultimate lawgiver in Pakistan or in Iraq or in Great Britain? Who is going to have the final say concerning how family life is to be constructed? What marriage is? What children are to learn? What is allowable? What is not allowable? When is a just war just? When is it right to go to war? When is it right to kill? It's never right to murder. But there are times when it is right to kill. There are times to remain silent. There are times to speak up. When is it? Who is going to be the final arbiter in all of these vexing questions that face all of us? And we're going to face Israel. They were to occupy a land that was already occupied by at least seven nations. And these seven nations were steeped in crass idolatry of our most disgusting kind. We already know something about the horrible religion of the Canaanites. And God is going to extirpate them. They have, as it were, polluted the land. And he is going to bring in another nation of 12 tribes to clean out and to clean up the land. But are they going to clean it up? Or are they going to fall into the old ways of these seven nations who already occupy the land of Canaan? In other words, what kind of people are they going to be? And what the Lord is saying, this is the kind of people you're going to be. This is the kind of religion that you're going to have. The 12 tribes, you're only going to have one God. You're not going to have any other gods before me or alongside me. Why does that need to be emphasized? Because every single nation in Canaan had its own gods. Not only one per nation, but many per nation. They had their goddesses. They had the gods for healing, the gods for thunder, the gods for planting, the gods for childbirth. They had the gods for making war. Everything under the sun would be covered by some god or goddess. And you would have to offer some bloody sacrifice to these brutal gods in order to win your way or to have whatever you'd. And the Lord is saying, you will have none of that. There will not be different gods among the different tribes. There will be one God only. And there will only be one rule book for each vicinity. The tribes were to divide up the land. But every single nation or every community within Israel was to have the same law. Not like Australia where there's a commonwealth. And there are some laws that don't apply in New South Wales that apply in Victoria. And there are some laws in Great Britain that apply in Scotland and don't apply in England. There's to be none of that nonsense. When you go into the land, there will be one lawgiver, there will be one God, there will be one religion, because you will be one people. And you will belong to a community that is seen to be different. What kind of persons are they to be? They're to be God-loving, God-fearing, God-obeying. They are to remember that it is written, it is written, it is written, thou shalt not do this, you will do this. This is how each individual life, every family life is to be governed. By whose rules do we live? Every family must, within the context of a rule, make up individual little rules. But they must never be our rules. They must always be within the confines of God's rules. And what I say to parents very often, and what I've said to my own family as well, if I may, because children say, well, why do we have to have these rules? And we have to tell them, it's not because daddy says so. Sometimes fathers rule with an iron hand, and what dad says goes. And sometimes what Dad says is sometimes not just quite what God says. And that's a tragedy. We make rules for our children and our families, not because they're our rules, but because they're God's rules. And all we're trying to do is implement God's rules. That's why they're to do this. What kind of nation are they going to be? Now, we know from the later history of Israel that they failed. They forgot. They forgot the law of Moses very often. That's why the prophets had to come back and remind them over and over again. They forgot that God had spoken to Joshua and through Joshua to the people, be strong and of good courage. They had forgotten that God was with them. They had forgotten how kind he was and good he was to them. Just the same as we often forget and we go our own way and we bring disaster. I believe that the Presbyterian Church of Eastern Australia is wandering around and doesn't seem to know exactly where it's going. Fighting rear guard actions most of the time, it seems to me. And we just don't seem to know what we're on about half the time. Only visit us in and listen to the debates. At times my heart's just in my boots as I listen to some of the speeches there. Because we seem to have just lost the vision of what really is important. And we spend a great deal of our time talking about things that ultimately are not all that important in the least, quite frankly. Because we've lost our way. We've gone to the left or to the right somehow or other. And we've forgotten to run with patience the race, looking unto Jesus. And these people in Israel, as they were entering into the promised land, they were going to be tempted by the beauty, by the women, by the food, by the wine, by the gods and the goddesses. They were going to be tempted by the sheer prosperity, a land flowing with milk and honey. They were going to be tempted in so many, many ways. And the Lord is saying to them, always remember what Moses said. Remember what God said. This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth. And so here at the very beginning of their occupation, before they even step a foot across the Jordan, they are being given a code book that is to be the fundamental law of Israel till the end of time. Because this book, yes, there are changes in the law, because there are changes of administration. But this book of the law is still our code book today. This is the code book of the Christian church. The law of Moses, the law of Jesus is not different to the law of Moses. Love to God, love to our neighbor. Walking in the fear and in the faith of the God who has saved us. And living before him as those who take heed, trembling, as it were, at his word. And it's as old as the religion of the Bible is old. And it's right up to date. This book of the law belongs to us as well, in principle, because Christ never intended to destroy one iota or one tittle of the law. The littlest symbols in the law were not to be obliterated by Christ. He came to explain it. He came to fulfill it. But the law stands intact. Not precisely for Israel and for us the same. Because for them, the code book of the law of Moses was not only the moral law. It was the civil code. It was the criminal code. That is why you could be put to death for committing sin in Israel. There may be things that you and I do that are sinful and from a moral point of view, are immoral things. But they may not be crimes. To commit adultery, for example, in Australia is not a crime. It may be a sin, but it's not a crime. But in Israel, it was a crime. And capital punishment followed it. That's the way it was. Because the moral law, the civil law, the ceremonial law, and the criminal law were one. They're not one today. Because they were given to Israel and given to no other nation. Because the church and Israel were one in Old Testament times. So there is a change. But the basic code book of what is written down in terms of our relationship to God and our relationship to man, summarized in the Ten Commandments, that is unchangeable. And all the commandments stand intact. And our happiness, our prosperity, Our well-being depends upon us knowing them and doing them, the Maker's instructions. We disobey them, and it's no surprise if our car doesn't function or if our washing machine doesn't function properly, because we are ignoring the best possible advice on how to take care of it. And it's like that with this book of the law that God gave to Israel. And so from the very beginning, they were to know what they were on about. They were to know who they were, why they were to live differently, and they were to know why it was that they were in the promised land at all, because it was something that God gave to them as a free and a generous gift of a father to his children. But there's a lot more to it than that, but I don't have any more time to talk any more about it. So let's just leave it there for this evening. May God bless his word to us.